are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Stay tuned at 10:30 for Stage and Studio. We'll hear Willamette Radio Workshop's presentation of A Christmas Carol. And now the topic is the Freedom Project, which supports the transition of prisoners into peacemakers to build safe communities founded on effective connections.
Potter, and I'm here in Bainbridge Island with Lucy Liu, and we're going to just talk about the work that Lucy's doing, which has to do with prisoners and teaching them to meditate and teaching them to talk compassionately to one another. And I'd like to just say hi, Lucy. We're in her house.
Hi,
and,
Stephanie.
And start by asking you a few questions. First of all, just tell us about the work that you're doing.
Well, I'm part of a group called the Freedom Project. And our mission is to support the transformation of prisoners into peacemakers. And we do this in several ways. We offer trainings inside prison in nonviolent communication and mindfulness. And then we also have trained a team, a combined team of what we call returnees, people who returned to the community from prison, partnered with people like myself, which we call NEBIs, no experience being incarcerated. So we are developing and training a team like this to be able to continue our work. And also on the outside, we do support work for returnees transitioning back into the community. And so those are sort of different ways in which we're really hoping to support our community in becoming safer in a, you know, safety-based, genuine connection and inclusion of everyone.
And so, basically, how would this be different than other sorts of prison transition projects?
There are lots of, I wish there were more. What's particularly unique about our program is that we offer these concrete skills and tools in nonviolent communication and mindfulness, which we believe really helps an individual connect deeply to his own values, his or her own values, and to live in integrity, and then also to have the skills to communicate truthfully and empathically with others.
So nonviolent communication, what exactly is that and how does that work?
Nonviolent communication was developed by Marshall Rosenberg, who is an international mediator and teacher. And I would say that the basic principle of nonviolent communication is that we stay connected from moment to moment with our needs and really speak out of that place rather than be communicating out of our heads in terms of what's wrong with a particular situation or person, to really center ourselves into what we are needing in this moment and to really be able to hear in whatever words the other person is saying, to be able to hear the needs underneath whatever judgments or criticism or screaming or anger or silence that we might be receiving from another person, to be able to really touch in to what's the deeper need. And we call this need is really a universal need, needs that we all share. So, you know, we all have a need for safety. We have a need for connection, for respect, for understanding. So even though we might be speaking and it may sound very violent, we may be conversing and what you're saying may sound very violent, but I am trusting as a person who uses nonviolent communication that I can really touch in to what we call your heart, to what is the need underneath all that violence. You know, sometimes it could just be for understanding, for some empathy. So this is a very powerful tool that, you know, personally those of us on the team have found have transformed our own lives, and so we're very inspired about sharing it with the people inside prison, also with people coming out.
And first of all, you say it's transformed your own life. When did you start getting involved with this?
I met Marshall Rosenberg in 1995, and For myself, I was a student of compassion, and I was meditating in this Buddhist tradition. But I was always very mystified in how I can be compassionate and truthful at the same time, because oftentimes it seems like my truth were not compassionate. And then when I met Marshall, I was so relieved, because almost immediately I saw that yes, it is possible for me to be completely truthful and completely compassionate at the same time. And so after I met him, I immediately signed up for a 10-day intensive, and I've pretty much devoted my life to deepening this practice since then.
Uh-huh. And then the meditation that you're doing, you're saying it's a kind of Buddhism, like any particular kind?
The particular practice that I do is called Vipassana Insight Meditation. And when we take this into the prisons, it's very secular, so we call it mindfulness, this mindfulness practice. And it's really being able to pay attention moment to moment, to become aware moment to moment to what's going on for ourselves. And inside prison, this is a very powerful practice, because so many people, when they are engaging in actions that they later regret, do so out of an impulsive place. And this mindfulness really allows us to see when the anger first arises, to notice what's happening in our bodies, and to be able then to see a little space in which we can actually take action and make choice. So this, coupled with the nonviolent communication, these two tools, we feel, have really been able to support people in finding a different way to live.
So you have a prisoner, he's really angry, he's really, or even you, upset. You say they're really screaming, "God damn you, how did you do that? Why are you doing that to me?" You're saying then that the people are able to find a space in there to just hear that, like it's just water, you know, rolling?
Well, is the anger being directed at them? Is the person actually experiencing the anger?
Okay, the person's experiencing the anger. Yeah.
Okay, so as somebody who's cultivating these practices, I would refine my ability to catch my anger earlier and earlier and earlier. So there's a pretty wonderful story about the Dalai Lama, that when he was very young, he said that, you know, there would be a mosquito on his, you know, on his arm or something, and without even knowing it, he'd go like this, and then he realized, oh, I just killed this mosquito. And in terms of living in integrity, for me, my value is to protect life, so I've just, you know, unconsciously made a choice that violated that particular value. And then as he got older, he says that then after a while he noticed that he would, well, I guess this is not good for Rita, because you can't really see.
Right, okay, yeah, she's slapping herself.
No, you go like that, and then stop right here, right before. And then after some more time passed, he would notice, oh, there's a mosquito, and he sort of do this with his arm so that the mosquito would be...
Just shrug his shoulder.
Yeah.
No slap. No even start to slap.
Right. And then after some more years, notice there's a mosquito, and then he'd very gently blow the mosquito off his arm. And then he told the story how right now when there's a mosquito, he just looks down at it and says, oh, the mosquito is having breakfast. So this is sort of, you know, a kind of humorous a way to illustrate his growing awareness and ability to live in harmony with his own values. And so if somebody is angry, so often, you know, we take action that is really not in alliance with what we are really wanting, how we want ourselves to be behaving. And so it's how early can we catch that, and whether we have the, the mindfulness to then step in, to stop, and then to, in NVC, we actually have these certain steps when we get angry, to be able to distinguish what the stimulus of the anger is, as opposed to what is really causing the anger, which is some need of ours that is, you know, not being met. And so we say that anger is actually always because we have some kind of should thought, that something should be or shouldn't be. And so it is, to me, it's the way in which we're resisting what is. We're having difficulty accepting what is right now, the reality. and then we go off into our thinking, and then the anger takes off. And so this particular NDC method actually gets us to slow down, to stop, to see the various components, and then to be able to get connected to the deeper need underneath the anger, and to then to see if we can meet that need rather than to be reactive with the anger, which is to, when we're angry, we want to punch people. We want to hurt somebody, you know, sometimes ourselves if we're angry at ourselves. But so instead of that energy, we bring us back to our center, get connected to our need, and once we realize the need, to be able then to see how we can address it.
And you're saying prisoners are able to, you know, these are people who, some of them have raped people or, I guess, robbed and even killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we work with all people with all kinds of different criminal backgrounds.
And you're finding that this is actually effective? They're able to slow down and stop? And
you know, it's an ongoing process, so it's not black or white. They're able to do it or they're not able to do it. But I feel very encouraged when I work with the people inside to see the receptivity that they have for both MEC and mindfulness, especially MEC. We've been emphasizing that mostly. And I have seen people who have really used this inside the prison. You know, they don't have to be coming out, where people ask them, you know, what's going on? You know, have you been going to church or something? So, yes, it is very applicable, but it is practice. You know, it's moment-to-moment practice.
And how many people are involved in it? I mean, you get people, like, wanting to join you, or do you have to, like, persuade them?
No, actually, you know, we have a pretty long waiting list. When we offer workshops, we always have a waiting list because we're pretty well established in two prisons in Washington State.
And what prisons are those?
Both prisons are in Monroe, and one is called the Twin Rivers Unit, and the other is the minimum security.
Mm-hmm. So you're well established, you say?
Yes, we've been there several years now, so our programs are known, and yeah, like I say, there's a long waiting list. I wish that we had more resources to have more trainers, but at this point, you know, we're really happy that we can offer sort of ongoing multi-day workshops there and also sort of month-long courses. And the workshop is a place where people can get excited and inspired. And the courses, which is ongoing practice, is a place where they can actually start to apply the tools and to practice it on a day-to-day basis, which is really important.
My experience actually with NVC is it's actually like learning a new language.
Yes. Yeah. It is like a foreign language, and it means a lot of unlearning of the way in which we habitually react to situations and to people that aren't doing what we'd like them to be doing.
Huh. And did you actually sell a house and buy a place and then start paying people to, like, learn how to do this?
Well,
I heard something about this.
Yeah, I was really inspired because when I was working inside the prison, I met a young man who was so enthusiastic about having this program inside prison. He was transferred to another prison, and he immediately established an NVC, a nonviolent communication program there, and had me go in. And he was going to be released after a pretty long sentence. And he said, you know, we can't just have this program inside. We need to continue out there so that when people come out, and he was thinking of himself coming out, of course, when people come out, that there is also this kind of support as they transition out, because that's a very difficult time. So I thought, yeah, I would really like to, you know, partner with him in creating an organization. And there were quite a few other trainers who were available at that time. And so I decided that I had this sort of old family house back east that was like a group house at that time, and it seemed like it had served its function, and so I decided to sell it and use the proceeds to really support this program. We created several internships for returnees. Several of them became trainers in the program, and that's kind of how we got started at using this as a seed money for the Freedom Project.
Wow, and that's been going on like 10 years now.
Oh, no, not quite that long. You know, we started in 2001, and, you know, we've been, we're starting to exhaust the seed money, and so this year is a really critical year. We are maturing into a kind of a regular community-based 501c3, and so we're needing to really develop our organization out so that we can really, you know, speak to the community and really share the importance of this work and to inspire a larger community to support us.
How many people have actually gone through the program then, would you say?
It depends on what you mean by gone through the program, because mm-hmm. we offer like 2 to 3 day trainings inside, but just in terms of statistics, if it means anything, I think we had 1,400 training hours last year. And what that means is we had 1,400 individuals, but some of them are repeats, each of whom got at least 3 to 8 hours of MEC mm-hmm. training. But we don't have a program where, you know, we register individuals and they follow through from beginning to end or anything like that.
It's just a series of workshops and people come and drop out and come back again, that kind of thing.
Right, yeah. and some courses that meet weekly. Yeah.
Right.
This is Stephanie Potter, and I'm speaking with Lucy Liu, the founder of the Freedom Project in Seattle. The Freedom Project was established to strengthen communities through supporting the transformation of prisoners into peacemakers.
And so, like, then how do you sort of decide, like, or what would you say a success is, or what kind of successes have you had then?
Yeah, it's really difficult in terms of statistics, because we don't have that kind of resources to be able to collect data and, you know, figure out how to evaluate in those ways. But we certainly have had a lot of people come out, and we can see how they are living out here. And also, I guess, we see how the community inside, for example, Twin Rivers Unit, because we've been there now for several years, we can see that there is really a community being built inside with people affecting each other, with, you know, the people who are older practitioners really inspiring new people to come in, and people, you know, talk about their lives, and we hear how they see each other also, how inside the way people are interacting with each other mm-hmm. Has changed.
Could you describe that, for instance, how, you know, the effect that it actually has, or how they change?
Well, for example, there's one man who told us how he was very, very prone to being angry. And in prison, face is a, you know, really, really important thing to protect. So he was talking about how at one point he was arguing with somebody, and, you know, one thing led to another, you know, and then suddenly this guy shoved him, and he found himself stumbling backwards, several feet, sliding on the ground. And he's a pretty rough and tumble guy, this fellow. And he says, you know, says throughout my life, you know, if anybody did that, especially in prison, doesn't matter how big he is or anything, I would get up and I'd be, you know, punching him in the face, because, you know, I cannot let anybody see me as being weak. And he said, you know, and just as he was about to jump up, he said something happened that never happened before. He said suddenly what flashed in front of his face was his family. I think he just had gotten married, and also he had a couple of young children. He says, my family, my freedom, you know, my children, my visits. You know, it's a big privilege to be able to have visits from your wife in this case. And he had gone through a lot in order to get those. He says, all that just flashed in front of my face. And I stopped. He says, you know, my fists were ready to strike, and something stayed them. And he says, he was so surprised at himself, but he realized that it was more important for him that these were the things that he really valued, rather than be able to prove to this other guy. And there were about 6 people looking on, which made it even harder. He said he turned around, he went outside, he ran around the track 3 times as fast as he could with tears stinging his eyes. And he said part of him felt like, oh, how could I have done that? And then another part of himself, he says, I realized for the first time in my life, I had made a choice to live my values. And he said, that was like a really important moment for me, that I can do that. So somehow, you know, who knows, you know, it's a mysterious process. How did he, in that moment, have those images flash in front of him?
And then another aspect of it is, 2 steps further is maybe to even have compassion for the fellow that punched him. I mean, do you hear those kinds of stories?
Well, yeah, so of course, maybe not exactly compassion, but what happened was that he said he was really worried about how people would be seeing him. But he said, I think there were 6 guys watching, 5 guys came to him, and he was really scared they would, like, see him as a punk and just start to take advantage of him. And they came up to him, they said, you know, we really respect what you did. And then 2 weeks later, the guy who had shoved him came up to him and thanked him for having stopped rather than having escalated. He says, because he said, he came up to this guy I'm talking about and said, I'm about ready to be released and my family is waiting for me and I wanted to thank you for having done this because if you hadn't, this wouldn't be happening. And so our fellow said, you know, he says, you know, it's not only was he happy, but his wife was happy. And he says, I'm really happy for his wife because she gets to have him now. And so I think that, you know, it's not exactly compassion, but I think you see that the hostility, there wasn't a big, conflict. So much of it is about in that moment of about saving face. And I think a court, everybody has this very core need, especially in prison, to know that I count, that I matter, that, you know, I have a place at the table and that I have some value. And so when you experience that being threatened in some way, I think the reaction is often to strike out. But when we are really practicing MVC, we start to recognize, you know, what are the deeper needs. And, you know, in this case, he realized, well, yeah, I have a need to know that I matter, I count, I make a difference, but I don't need to get it from the other fellow. You know, it's all about respect, this basic core need. And I think people start to recognize that respect is really internal. And if I can give it to myself, I don't have to have him behaving in a certain way or talking in a certain way to me. And so this fellow was able to free himself from that. And that's really powerful when you can free yourself from situations like that and from that kind of sense of being held back by how other people are behaving towards you.
And then just to maybe relate that to the world at large.
Yeah, I think that for me, what I've really recognized that 95% of the time when I'm angry, it's really out of this need that I'm not recognizing. The need for respect, the need to know that I'm somebody, I make a difference, I matter, I have a place, that I belong or that I have value. And if I am sensing that somebody, you know, might have some thoughts where I'm not counting, I think I get very reactive. But what I'm really seeing, like I was mentioning to you, is that I need to be able to offer that to myself. And I believe that in our larger world, you know, whenever there's that pride and everything else underneath it is shame. And the fear that we don't count, that we don't matter, that we don't, you know, make a difference, that we don't belong, that we don't have a place at the table, that we don't have value. So to me, to recognize that that's just a basic human need that I can hold tenderly, and yes, it gets triggered, but it's not about the other person or the other party. That's freeing to me, and as a society, I think if we can really also recognize that we don't need to react to every trigger that comes up.
Well, you'll hear, like, for instance, well, 9/11, how could you possibly not react to that?
Yeah.
How would MVC, for instance, have operated in that situation?
I think MVC always operates out of the consciousness of needs. So when that happened, what need of ours was not being met? And if we look at that, obviously, a major need is that of safety. But if I wanted to meet my need for safety, what would I do? Would I go out to punish somebody or attack somebody? I mean, there's just many strategies to meet that need of safety. But the first thing I need to be aware is, okay, it's my need for safety above all that I'm wanting to protect. There may be other needs. That's why I'm saying that. The sense of embarrassment, of shame, that feeling, where does that come from? And I think it comes from that need for respect, the need to know that, you know, that I have a place. But if I knew that, that's my need, I would also know that there are many ways of meeting that need, and that beating somebody else or destroying somebody else may not be the best way to meet my need for respect. So I think MEC really wants us to get clear on what our needs are and not to react out of an aversion towards what happened externally.
So in other words, the U.S. government could start taking lessons from prisoners and...
Oh, I think that, yes. I have learned, so I wouldn't be going back if I wasn't, you know, just learning so much and being so rewarded by the time I spend inside prison.
So Is there anything that you'd like to just sort of finish up with or add to all this?
Yeah, I just would like to, I guess, encourage our community to recognize that the United States, with 5% of the world's population, has 25% of the world's prisoners, and that, you know, with 2 million people incarcerated, that we have the highest per capita incarceration rate in the world. And it's really, I think, hurting our community terribly to be addressing crime and violations of our social norms by trying to put people away, eliminate them, exile them from our community, and hope that this can be a way in which we can heal as a community. So I guess I really hope that as a society that we recognize that it's not by, you know, getting rid of that we can in the long run really create safety, and that safety really can only be created if we are willing to work with each other to prevent crime rather than to, you know, try to get rid of people who have committed crimes.
Calling them bad and just sending them off.
Yeah, ostracizing and making it difficult for them to come back into society. The harder we make it, the more likely it is that they will experience a lot of stress and a lot of pain, which only leads people to resort back to old habits of getting their needs met in unmindful and often destructive ways. It's so counterproductive, and I really want us to, you know, really address that.
Great. Well, thanks.
Yeah.
It's been great talking to you, Lucy. And this was Lucy Liu, who's involved with the Freedom Project in Seattle. To find out more, you can visit the Freedom Project at www.freedom-project.org. That's freedom-project.org. I'm Stephanie Potter with KABU.
Between the Covers was made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from St. John's Books, North Portland's full-service independent bookstore offering new and used books on progressive politics, literature, poetry, titles for kids, and more. St. John's Books is located at 8622 North Lombard in St. John's. Information at 503-283-0032. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. At 11 a.m. on today's Democracy Now!, critical mass bike rides face police crackdown in New York. New video surveillance shows New York Police Department covert surveillance of cyclists and protests. Quote, "It's an excellent relationship," unquote, says New York Police Department on police and CIA links.